United States versus Hanhart, Mr. Cole.
Judge Posner, and may it please the court. It is our position, Your Honor, that what we have to say is said comprehensively in the briefs, and with your permission, unless the court has questions, I'd like to reserve all my time for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you, sir.
So, Mr. Stays?
May it please the court, Your Honor, I'm here on behalf of Joseph Basinski, and I would like to address this morning briefly the organized crime departure that was imposed in this case. This case is simple from this perspective. It is about jewelry thieves who identified jewelers, who targeted them, who stole their jewelry, and sold that jewelry to fences. The single question that I think is presented to this court is whether or not that sort of conduct is the kind of conduct that is significantly unique or rare to take it outside the heartland of jewelry theft. And I think the question is at once rhetorical. That is the heartland of jewelry theft.
There are factual differences, surely. And on an abuse of discretion standard of review, are you saying that the judge can't take into account factual differences among one jewelry theft versus, you know, so many years of other jewelry theft?
The court can, but that was not the basis upon which the court departed. The court departed solely on the basis of affiliations with or associations with.
Oh, I know it, but I'm just saying if the mechanism for these particular jewelry thefts were use of organized crime connections, that's not even a fact that can be considered in your view?
It can be considered, and Judge, I believe it's subject, thanks to the new Amber legislation, to de novo review. But this court has enunciated the test for consideration of that very factor, and that is where organized crime is used as an offensive weapon to facilitate the crime. To fit within the ambit of this court's cases, it would be simple. If Mr. Basinski came up to these folks and said to a jeweler, "We know where you live, we know where your kids live, and if you don't give us your jewelry, we will kill you," that would be the renowned case that Judge Posner offered. That was not the case here. If he just said to them, "We will kill you or put you in a trunk if you do not give us your wares," that would be the Schweiz case. If he tells the jeweler that "we will beat you over the head so much until your head turns black," that would be the Zizzo case. But that is the antithesis of what happened in this case, where violence and confrontation were avoided at all costs. If mere association with organized crime could suffice without it facilitating the offense, if that was enough, you would have three absurd results. First of all, you would have the obvious disparity of the departure being imposed on people who, in fact, did use murder and did use violence in their organized crime connections to perpetrate an offense, as opposed to a person with organized crime affiliations who used none of those things, who was, for whatever else you could say about him, a peaceable person. That is the sort of disparity that the guidelines historically has always sought to avoid. You would have the absurd result of the departure being used in run-of-the-mill federal crime cases. It is a federal crime to turn back your odometer. But to suggest that because one happens to be a member of organized crime who didn't use that to facilitate that simple act, that is the basis to depart from 213.1, it is absurd. And third, the use of organized crime or the affiliation with organized crime would be the basis for wholesale, widespread floodgate departures in all kinds of run-of-the-mill cases. But that is the antithesis of what guideline departures are all about. As the Supreme Court tells us in Coon, as the Sentencing Commission has said time and again, that is just not what the departure was intended for. And no case has recognized it here. And Judge Norville never identified how organized crime was used as an offensive weapon, which is seen throughout all of this court's cases to facilitate crime. And unless there are more questions, I would like to reserve my time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stays. Mr. Martin?
That was Sam. I represent Guy Altobello, Mark Martin. With respect to the standard review, the government at page 44 of its brief cites the new law, which changes the standard of review. On the organized crime point, in its brief, the government states that Mr. Altobello was one of the three appellants who was a member of an Ogden Grand street crew controlled by Joseph Lombardo. This comes out of left field. The notion that Mr. Altobello was a street crew member was nowhere in the government's pleadings below that I can find, and it wasn't the basis of the district court's ruling. The government's defense of Mr. Altobello as to the organized crime enhancement is very sparse. It says that it should be upheld, and we adopt our colleague's arguments on that point. In the time I have allotted to me, the point I'd like to bring to the court's attention with respect to Altobello is obstruction of justice. I think it needs to be made clear that the district court here imposed the obstruction based on Mr. Altobello's unsworn statements to FBI agents when they came to his place of business and spoke to him about an intercepted telephone conversation that had occurred.
So is it clear Judge Norville didn't base any part of the obstruction enhancement on a perjury?
Yes, Your Honor, and at page 61 of the sentencing transcript, which of course is attached in our appendix, when the government made that argument, he said, I don't have to go that far, and I'm not making that finding, and he didn't make that finding. I think what we're driving at here is the effect of the Buckley case on this case.
Your argument is that the enhancement on the basis of the unsworn statements was improper because there's no indication the unsworn statements had any effect on the investigation. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what the probation officer found. The government, in its brief, really doesn't explain how it affected the investigation. The district court found that the indictment could have been returned earlier. There's not evidentiary support for that, no FBI agent.
Did the judge say anything about these unsworn statements might have disrupted the investigation, thrown a monkey wrench into the business?
He did not state that. I mean, it seems to come from the Buckley case, and he didn't use that analysis. And I think what the point is it's out there.
What's out there?
It's out there that the defense took the position that the starting date for Mr. Altobello was 95-96. The government said it was 93, and there was that dispute. And Altobello persisted in his claim and said the government has improved his involvement at an earlier date. So that's out there. And what the government says on appeal is that this court can affirm for a different reason than the district court imposed the enhancement. They can affirm because Mr. Altobello took this position at the sentencing hearing. But to do that, Your Honor, you would have to substitute not a difference in judgment on a legal point, but you'd have to make a finding of fact. And you'd have to
make. What was Judge Norville's basis for the truth?
The false statements to the FBI agent in March of 1998.
And what was the false statement?
The extent of the false statement is also something that is arguable because two FBI agents came into Mr. Altobello's place of business and they played an intercepted conversation between Altobello and Mazinski. Mr. Altobello said, that's my voice on the tape. I know Mr. Mazinski. I had engaged in wagers with him. He said, I did a bad thing with him. And he didn't go into a lot of detail. He said, I did a bad thing with him. I was wrong and I'm going to have to pay for what I've done. Something to that effect. I may be summarizing here. He also said that was the only thing that he had ever done with Mr. Mazinski. So according to the government, he did not admit the full details of his criminal involvement. And several cases from this court are cited in our brief say that if you admit the elements of the offense, and the government conceded, Mr. Altobello admitted his guilt to the agent, but he didn't go into the extent of his involvement. And the cases say if you admit your guilt, but you don't go into the extent of your involvement, that's not material obstruction under the meaning of the guidelines.
And how did Judge Norville deal with that issue?
He just made the general finding, in my opinion, that the false statements to the FBI agent had obstructed the investigation because the government could have brought the investigation.
Now, do I understand what you said? You said the law is that if you start, you tell somebody part of what you've done, but not all of it, you have been candid?
I'm not saying you've been candid. I'm not saying you've been candid, but not all obstruction.
Could a failure to fully disclose be considered a false statement?
Yes, it could be considered a false statement, but not all false statements warrant the obstruction enhancement. Could be dealt with by
other. Whether it could be considered a false
and
a false statement by itself is a violation of the law. False statement.
It's material. Yeah. It's material.
Yeah, well, we assume that we're discussing a crime and you don't discuss it in its entirety. It's material.
Well, I don't want to use my colleague's time, but if you read...
I'm not using his time. If you read mine, go ahead.
Your time's most important, Judge Bauer.
Not to me.
But if you read...
I can pay by the month, but go ahead.
Parker, the defendant of the plea hearing, said, I had a $200 take from the bank robbery. He then changed his testimony and said it was $1,252. Son, the defendant said, I didn't take the marijuana out of the trunk, someone else did. And then it turned out the judge believed that Sen took the marijuana out of the trunk.
But that's not on a false statement to an official, is it?
In Parker, it was a false statement to a judge.
There's no logic in a false statement to a judge or what happened to him.
In Sen, it was a false statement to a jury.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Podliska?
Your Honors, may it please the Court. John Podliska for the United States. Mr. Hanhart has reserved all of his time for rebuttal, so what stands before the Court is, in its entirety, his accusation against the district court.
Why don't you start with his last point and clean that up about Altobello's enhancement for obstruction. So he made false statements to police officers, but I don't see where Judge Norgel found that by doing so he, you know, threw a monkey wrench into the investigation.
Well, I believe he said that it did, but the problem is that there's no articulation in the record as to the details of how that, in fact, occurred.
I didn't think he ever used that phrase. I thought he talked about it having the effect of trying to minimize, he used that term, I'm sure, Altobello's role. And he seems to be complaining about both certain things Altobello said and maybe even more importantly, lots of things Altobello chose not to say in the course of this discussion. But his findings are really woefully brief on not only this point, but many others.
That's correct, they are. He did not articulate the basis for the obstruction of the government's investigation, and the record doesn't show that.
And isn't there sort of a legal confusion here between activities that Altobello may have engaged in that amounted to obstruction versus things that he did that might have entitled him to acceptance of responsibility? I mean, if you want acceptance of responsibility, we know that you have to be forthcoming, you have to tell, and all of that stuff, but every failure to earn acceptance of responsibility isn't an obstruction, is it?
It is not, but he did end up engaged in a colloquy with the court. He did address the court at sentencing, and he persisted in his...
Yeah, but the judge didn't base this on perjury, so that's an independent basis for obstruction. Is that what you're asking us to do, say, with obstruction per se, because he made a perjurious statement?
We are, Your Honor, that's correct. That the obstruction that he's engaged in, the position that he took when he was interviewed by the agents in 1998, he persisted in that position, and he didn't simply remain silent, in which case he wouldn't have gotten acceptance of responsibility. He affirmatively came forward with continued assertions that he hadn't met Mr. Baczynski until 1995, that he hadn't had any dealings with him until 1996.
But what's the government's evidence on that point? That was another aspect of his appeal, of course, and that too looked astoundingly thin to me. Concrete evidence that puts Altobello in this conspiracy before, let's say, 1995, if we assume he's involved in the Cashamalic robbery.
Yes. The conspirators maintained information on the people that they were stalking. They had a form that they used that they filled in with information and data about these traveling salesmen. One of the forms that was recovered in the materials of one of the conspirators was a form that contained information about one of the salespersons who had been at Altobello, and he referred to it as Altobelli's, for 5 hours in October of 1993.
Right, you're talking about the business card, which is reproduced in the record, but I don't see anything on that card that authenticates who wrote those pieces of information down. Whether it was Altobello, why he would spell his own name wrong. I mean, it seems to me it's the flimsiest of I don't...
The government's position was not,
No, go ahead.
That Mr. Altobello wrote that document. He certainly did not. That's one of the conspirators gathering information. It was found in the materials of Mr. D'Antonio.
But what if it meant the Altobello Jewelry Company, which was owned by his son, as I recall?
Well, it does refer to the jewelry company owned by his son, which is where he worked and where he was a bird dog for this organization.
And so every person who worked at Altobello Jewelry Company, in your view, had been in this conspiracy since 1993?
Oh, certainly not. He was the one, though, that was caught on tape talking when we were up on the wire, talking to Mr. Baczynski.
Right, but not in 1993. I'm just saying, I think this card, you're asking it to bear more weight than it can, aren't you?
Well, that's one piece of evidence. The robbery, the thefts from Mr. Kashamalik is another.
Right, he's in 1995. So I want to know 94, 93, 92.
I understand. Mr. Kashamalik was robbed twice.
93?
Yes. And once it became clear that the connect to this conspiracy was that he had been a supplier to Altobello Jewelers, that is the connect that ties Mr. Altobello to this theft in 1993. These conspirators had means of gathering information about their target. The principal one was to go to trade shows where Mr. Kashamalik didn't go. And so the problem for our investigation all along was, how did they find this man? Where did they locate him? How did they come to target him in the first place? And we learned that in November of 2001, when we learned for the first time that Altobello Jewelers was a customer of his.
It seems possible to me that somebody could have told Mr. Altobello in 1995 that there had been this prior robbery of Mr. Kashamalik, or he might have been involved with it. I don't know where the tiebreaker evidence is.
Well, the tape that was made, there was only one tape from the government's wiretap that was up in 1996. And Mr. Altobello would give, the only thing he would concede was the evidence that existed from 1996 that he couldn't deny because it was right there on tape. But the text of that conversation, this is not a first-time conversation for these two people.
Oh, clearly not.
They're talking in cryptic terms. They're talking in a jargon where each one very clearly understands the other. This is not the first time that he supplied information about a jeweler who's been at that jewelry store.
But the classic obstruction is where you send the police off on a wild goose chase by, you know, fingering someone else or what have you. So if all he did was deny a prior being complicit back in 1993. Yes, granted, if he had been candid, it would have helped your investigation, but his mere failure to cooperate in obstruction of justice, isn't that what you're saying? Failure to cooperate is obstruction of justice?
No, he affirmatively lied as to what his relationship was with Mr. Baczynski.
Sure. Lying, deny, yes, that's not cooperating. But if you just deny guilt, it's that obstruction of justice. Now, if you perjure yourself, you deny it under oath at trial, yes, perjury, then you get the obstruction enhancement. But if you don't perjure yourself, you just lie, and the lies consist simply of denials rather than of, say, sending them off on a wild goose chase, then I don't know what basis you have for the obstruction enhancement.
Well, Your Honor, that is the government's position. We've set it out in the briefs, and we really don't have anything to add beyond what
okay,
we
Okay, let me ask you about you wanted to talk about Hanhart. The thing I find troublesome about Hanhart is the suicide, because it seems that Judge Norgel took the position that even if this was a serious suicide attempt, it would still be obstruction of justice, because if you kill yourself, you can't show up for your hearing. I find that strange.
What Judge Norgel articulated was that the act of taking the medication, how much it was,
suppose he killed himself, could the government obtain a fine against his estate on the ground that he had...
No, it could not. And there's evidence in the record, indeed it came from the defense itself.
So if you try to kill yourself, you better succeed.
Well, what Mr.
You're punished for failing to kill yourself. Right? That's what it amounts. You get an obstruction of justice if you don't complete your attempt.
What Mr. Hanhart did articulate was the theory and the notion that if he was convicted in this case and the case went to fruition, that his family could be destroyed financially from the financial consequences of this case, that by taking his own life, what he was going to do was to end the prosecution of the case. Now, it's a morbid concept to consider, but is that obstruction of justice? Yes, it is.
Why? Is that... I mean, well...
But if he kills himself, he saves the government a lot of money prosecuting.
Doesn't help the victims, Your Honor. They're waiting to try and get restitution. We've got forfeiture provisions in this indictment. There's an old concept here that a criminal case ends when the defendant dies that derives mostly from the days when we just used to put people in jail. If he's dead, he's not going to serve his jail time. Now there's all kinds of financial consequences to criminal prosecutions, not just for the government, but for the victims as well.
I don't believe it. Because he dies, he has an estate, and the estate can pay, restitution to the victims.
There's no conviction, right?
Pardon?
There's no conviction.
Civil restitution.
We're not talking about the
lower burden of proof.
We're not talking about the civil context.
You're talking about the victims. The victims can obtain restitution civilly with a lower burden of proof than the government. So how are they hurt?
How are they going to prove their case, Your Honor?
Same way that everybody proves their case.
Not with the wiretap, but not with the wiretap evidence of ours, Your Honor.
Why would that be available to them?
I don't know that would be, Your Honor.
Why wouldn't it be? It's available, it's there, everybody knows about it. Why aren't you subject to that? It's not grand jury testimony, subject to secrecy, it's there available.
Well, it remained under seal in this case, Your Honor.
I know, but I'm saying it remained under seal until he died, and then it wouldn't be, the reason for it being under seal ceases to exist. You have no particular reason to hide it from the plaintiffs in the civil case.
Well, he would be dead, Your Honor, but there are other people that were involved in those wiretaps, and it may be a more complicated issue than that as to what...
Well, not necessarily more complicated, but we're not precluding them from using evidence available for the civil suit as well as the criminal.
And it would then be a situation that always exists where there's a parallel proceeding that may go on in civil proceedings.
Suppose instead of committing suicide, he just hauled off and died. Would the victims then be frustrated in their position, or would they be able to bring action against this estate and use whatever was available?
Well, they would be frustrated in their ability to benefit from a criminal prosecution that did not involve the...
Well, criminal prosecution is also under the doctrine recently, Ali Sakh, that they have been fairly proven. They couldn't take... Unless on the plea of guilty, they couldn't use that as a judicial admission, so they couldn't use the conviction itself anyway, could they?
They would be at square one. They would have the burden of proving their case. That's a different position to be in than to be a victim in a criminal case that has gone to prosecution.
It's easier for them to collect the money out of the criminal prosecution.
Yes, there's no question
about that.
And we're talking about victims here that are scattered across the country. There's wide range.
But the question put to you by Judge Plaster is, why is it obstruction of justice? Unless you assume that justice requires that the victims be reimbursed or be made whole.
Restitution would be mandatory, Your Honor.
But the government isn't hurt, right? The government's investigation is not impeded if the defendant kills
him. It's a question of who gets hurt, whether the government's case is hurt by his attempted suicide or not. And the answer is the government's case is not. The restitution is.
Well, the attempted suicide does hurt the government's case, Your Honor, because it stops it in its tracks. It would not go forward.
I mean, but here's the statement Judge Norgel makes. He says, and this is on page 25 of your brief, if it is correct that he coincidentally intended to end his own life, it does not obviate the fact that he knew that by taking what he took, the result would be that he would not be in this courtroom. Now, there's something profoundly troubling about that statement, since, as the probation officer put it, to end one's life is one of the most profound moral things that you can do. And even for him, presumably, there were far more consequences than simply not having to go all the way through the trial. I had a much more minute question about this for you. Are you arguing that it's the suicide attempt as a whole, or are you arguing separately that when he decided to try to check himself into Bethany Hospital, that was a separate act of obstruction after he's recovering from the pills?
The district court based its ruling on the alternative grounds of, first, the attempt, his conduct in not appearing in court on Monday the 18th. But the second alternative ground, an additional ground that the court found, was his deliberate decision to not comply with the court's order to be in court on Friday. He didn't voluntarily check himself into Bethany Hospital. What he did when he was in Highland Park, without notice to the court, without leave of court, without notice to the government, and it would appear without any notice to his lawyers, because we didn't find out from them what he was doing. He was making arrangements to check into Evanston Hospital, into a program that would have required him, by doctor's orders, to be there a minimum of 5 and as much as 10 days.
Of course, the doctor's orders can always be superseded by the court orders.
Well, exactly. That was my thought. I couldn't imagine why you weren't acknowledging that if the court needed him, the court could make sure the right medical arrangements were made to get him into the courtroom.
The court's order was for him to appear that Friday. He never came forward. If he'd asked for permission to do that, it's another matter. But that is what it requires.
You said the judge ruled in the alternative. I don't see that. I see him mushing it all together. He said, under all the circumstances here, I don't see where you think he has independent grounds for the obstruction finding.
Well, Your Honor, I can't cite the chapter. I could file something later with the court if you wish, but there was...
I was looking at your own brief in which you
understand
to summarize the judge's position.
Well, the difficulty...
Is there anything alternative about that?
Well, the difficulty is, Your Honor, that portion of it that we did quote does not show where he's saying that he's making the decision with both with respect to the failure to appear on Monday and then the decision that Mr. Hanna made.
I understand he's considering both of them. The question is whether they added up in his mind or whether they were completely independent from each other.
Oh, I'm sorry. I understand. I don't know that he's saying that those are completely independent, completely independent grounds as opposed to being part of one decision.
Okay. That was my... Yeah.
We're not making that distinction.
I mean, there are a number of places, getting back to the upward departure for organized crime connections, where the only thing Judge Norgel seems to say is, I've considered, you know, sort of this little recitation, I've considered mountains of evidence, Title III wiretaps, all the evidence, and this is my conclusion. And as I was reading through the briefs in this case, I kept thinking, which part of the mountain are you talking about? I mean, which evidence specifically are you relying on? Because these generic statements are of very little help.
Well, Your Honor, on April 29th in the proceedings with respect to Mr. Hanhart at page 10 of that transcript, there is a stipulation that was entered into by Mr. Hanhart that in which it was stated that there was a stipulation through a two-point upward departure for use by the conspirators of organized crime connections in the commission of the offense. So that is the starting point. The person who was leading this organization is entering into a stipulation, and he's talking about the conspirators, plural. He's committing on behalf of everybody involved in this that they used organized crime connections in the commission of offense. There is a more generalized statement in the plea agreement of Mr. DiStefano as well, that organized crime connections were used in the commission of the crime.
What
where he
is
agrees
the
with 2 points up a
start. Strongest connection or the biggest connection with organized crime?
Mr. Hanhart.
And the connection operates how?
Well, Mr. Hanhart has connections
this
in both.
This fellow Brown, is that it? Did he?
Well.
How did Hanhart use organized crime connections?
What he had was access to an organized crime theft crew. There was CI information that identified Mr. Sherrill, Mr. Brown, Mr. Brzezinski, all three of them as members of this crew, Mr. D'Antonio, who died during the course of the conspiracy, as members of the street crew of Joseph Lombardo.
So Hanhart sort of got his foot soldiers from the outfit?
Well, he got access to that crew, Your Honor, to use it for his purposes and to benefit from it. And at this point, let me say, too, that the defense is correct with respect to Mr. Altavello. That's a misstatement on page 44 of the government's brief where we've included him in the Lombardo speed crew. The people in the crew, the detail that in the next following paragraph is correct. There was, however, information from Mr. Siegel, one of the informants, with respect to Mr. Altavello, that he was closely associated with James Turello, who was a Chicago outfit boss. That's in the government's supplemental sentencing submission, Exhibit A at page 3. So we did misstate that, and I apologize to the court for that. That should not have been there. But the connect, as Your Honor was asking for, is this is the street crew. And, of course, that's informant testimony, and it was subject to the criticism. We don't know who these people are and what kind of criminal records they have and so forth. But when they were stalking Mr. Lasterman, the salesman that they were following in 1996, when we were up on the wire, and we were following them, when Mr. Baczynski and Mr. Hanhart got ready to strike, they needed more than the two of them by their decision. And who showed up on the scene was precisely two of the people that had been predicted by the informant to be members of this crew, Mr. Shiro and Mr. Brown.
Now, what was Altobello's connection then? Since he wasn't actually a member of the street crew, what was...
His job, Your Honor, was to identify jewelers.
No, I understand that was his role in the crime, but what was his connection to organized crime? Because he got an organized crime enhancement.
I'm sorry.
He got an organized crime.
Yes.
So what was his organized crime connection?
Well, it's the connection there that I stated from the informant information as to his connect there to organized crime. And that really is in a...
No, I'm sorry. What is Altobello's connection?
That he was associated with James Turk Torello, who was a Chicago outfit boss.
But well, what does that mean? I mean, I don't get that. He's just associated with some guy. But how does that affect his criminal activity?
Well, what it meant, for instance, Your Honor, was that he was a fence, that stolen jewelry would be brought to him. Mr. Siegel testified that the proceeds of a robbery in 1989 were spent by him.
Okay, organized crime people would bring jewelry to Altobello to fence. But what does that have to do with Altobello's involvement with this group of criminals?
To be a part of this group, Your Honor, you can't be an outsider. Identifying as we have all of these people as the members of this crew, they don't allow volunteers to come into this. The people that are working with them...
Are you saying that the reason that Hanhart enlisted Altobello was that Altobello is a pal of this fellow, Torello, whatever his name was, and his offense was a trustworthy person? Is that what you're saying?
He enlisted him because he was associated with members of organized crime, and he was in a position to bird dog for this organization, to spot for the steps.
No, that's the second part. No, but that's not the organized crime part. You're saying the organized crime part, he's enlisted because he's trustworthy, because organized crime will vouch for him, something like that.
Well, that's what brings him into this organization, right? Because what they're doing is not something that they're going to invite outsiders to view. I see that my time is up, Your Honor. There were several other points, of course, that were raised. We'll stand on our brief and ask that the sentences as to all of these defendants be affirmed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pavlovskan. Mr. Cole, do you want to reply?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Let me make a correction to something Mr. Podliska said. He said, in connection with the suicide, that it was articulated by Mr. Hanhart that the reason that he decided to kill himself was to end the prosecution of the case, apparently to save his family not only financial harm, but apparently some embarrassment and so on. I am not aware at all that that was ever argued to Judge Norgal. It is not in the briefs that are presented to the court. It is most assuredly not the basis that the district court concluded that the enhancement was appropriate and there was an obstruction of justice, and therefore it is inappropriate for this court to substitute that as a
reason. No, the statement never made, Mr. Cole.
Your Honor, I honestly can't say that it is. Mr. Stays tells me that it was made, and I accept that. It most certainly was not made to Judge Norgal in support of the argument, and Judge Norgal...
But there was an explanation for the attempted suicide.
No, sir, it was not.
To whom? Well...
The statement apparently was made, and maybe Mr. Podliska can tell you, or somebody from our side can tell you, I do not know exactly when that statement was made. I do know it was never made as a justification or a basis for an argument that there was an obstruction of justice. What we do know is this, that on the day before he was to appear in court to plead, or in lieu of a plea, to obviously have the case set for trial, He attempted to kill himself, Judge Bauer. What is not at issue, although Judge Norville hinted sort of obliquely that it might be, although he refused to make a finding, was that this was a genuine, legitimate, honest-to-God suicide attempt.
What were the means used?
Pills, Your Honor. He took triple the dosage of whatever the prescription medicine was that he was taking. There was no dispute about it. The government conceded the suicide attempt was legitimate. That confession is quote...
That's a funny way to put it. Serious.
Right.
Serious attempt.
He really tried to kill himself.
The government's brief says he took 4 sleeping pills and 20 OxyContin pain-killing pills.
Well, if that's the amount, I can tell you that I know that it was triple the dosage that he was otherwise to take. The probation department found and told Judge Norville, in its view, it was a legitimate suicide attempt. In other words, you're right.
24 pills at once?
That's my understanding.
Sounds like more than 3 times.
Well, whatever, the dosage, as I understand it, was more than 3. The probation department said that this was not a feigned suicide attempt. The government conceded before Judge Norville, at least at one point, that there was no question that this was not a feigned attempt. And so that's the way the case proceeded. What Judge Norville then did was to come up with what I thought was really an extraordinary conclusion, given the dynamics of suicide, given the reality of life, and given what we know about suicide. And that is his attempt to kill himself, his intent to terminate his life, this extraordinary moral decision, was really, and this is his word, quoted in the government's brief, coincidental to the overarching design not to be in court on the 16th.
Well, alluding to the, you know, the old saw, a person intends the natural and probable consequences of his act. So if you kill yourself, you know you're not going to show up in court the next day.
That's not quite what he said. He didn't want to say that the intent...
That's the logic of it, right?
Maybe. The intent to kill oneself was not of major significance. That's very different, it seems to me, than the old saw, the old axiom that a person intends the natural and probable consequences of their acts, which really isn't the law pretty much anywhere anymore, and it's not even an appropriate jury instruction in civil or criminal cases. What Judge Norville wanted to do was to sort of make this thing, this awful, terrible act, into an obstruction. And that's what he did. And the only way that he could do that and avoid the constrictors of what the case law talks about in the guidelines and the intent of the guidelines was to say his willful, intentional act was not to be in court on the 16th. That's the only way he could get to where he got to. And so what did he say? He used this unusual analogy. He intended to shoot himself in the foot to avoid service on the front line.
Unfortunate choice of
him. Well, it was a very calculated choice, though. It is unfortunate, but calculated. The real analogy, of course, is he attempted to kill himself to avoid shooting himself in the foot, the shooting himself in the foot being to appear on the 16th, only either to plead or to set the case for trial. Now, in the fullness of time, Judge Norville may have left the bench, he may have been replaced, he may have recused him. Any number of things could happen that would obviate the embarrassment that Mr. Podlyska alluded to, the fact of going to trial, a better deal could have been made. He killed himself for the reason that most despairing people kill themselves, and that is to end their life, not to obstruct justice in the United States.
And it's the absolute top point of self-criticism. You can't get any more critical, self-critical than kill yourself.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that if we look at what the texts talk about in terms of suicide, there is one common thread that runs through all of the text, including the one the government cited with apparently not bothering to read beyond the title, and that is this. There is a psychopathology that runs through suicide, and that people who are in the kind of despair and depression that Mr. Panhart was feeling, perhaps self-induced, probably self-induced, do not act in a rational way. There is a rational suicide. People who are terminally ill, for example.
But I don't talk like this to irritate other people, though.
No, you don't do that. That's right.
Yeah, you don't?
No, I don't think you do.
Well, husbands have been known to kill themselves to get back at their wives and vice versa. Just, hell, mm-hmm. Just a show.
Well, your experience, Your Honor, is a good deal broader than mine. I'm not aware of that, of that
you're
family.
You're quite right, it is. If your experience is that, then the answer is yes. My experience is greater than yours.
If we look at this on a legalistic level, if we look just at the guideline language, what the guideline says is that you can't have an enhancement for conduct that is produced by confusion, mistake, faulty memory, or for spontaneous act. Certainly, Mr. Hanhart's suicide falls within those exclusions.
I think I could safely move on to another topic.
All right, Judge. Let me just say the last. Let me just conclude with the last, because that's all Mr. Podlitzka talked about. And that was this apparently alternative ground that the district court found for imposing the obstruction, and that is when he didn't show up again because he was in the hospital. I don't see that as an alternative ground. It is certainly not articulated by Judge Norkel, and if that's so, it's simply wrong. Again, the facts are these. Mr. Hanhart was told by a doctor whose credibility and competency were never challenged that he ought to be in the hospital because, of course, as you know from the briefs, that the potentiality for suicide for somebody who commits it once is quite strong in the event that they, in the succeeding days and in weeks after the first attempt. So what he did was he followed the doctor's orders. The validity of those orders, I think, is best illustrated by the fact that when Judge Norgel ordered Mr. Hanhart arrested, he ordered him to be confined to Bethany Hospital on suicide watch, where he was chained to a bed. Again, if we bring the facts back into the framework of the guidelines, we do not punish for obstruction under 3C1.1 if there is confusion or mistake. Well, a person who stays in a hospital pursuant to a qualified doctor's instructions following a suicide attempt is certainly acting under either a mistake or faulty memory. There simply was no willful attempt to obstruct. I think Judge Norgel was wrong, and I think that for all of the reasons set forth in our brief, the sentences should be reversed. And I appreciate your patience. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cole. Mr. Stays, I think you have some time.
Press time and again to explain how the organized crime connections facilitated this offense. Mr. Podlitzka continually harkened back to mere association. I think a simple illustration will make the point why that won't work.
But he said that Hanhart recruited from organized crime and brought in Altabella because these people were more trustworthy.
Well, there is no evidence of that, Judge. But what he really says is that he associated with his co-defendants, without explaining how there was any kind of facilitation. If five organized crime members start a Kool-Aid stand, but they determine that they're going to underreport their revenues, that to be sure is a crime conspiracy. The fact that organized criminals have made that determination did not facilitate that crime in the way envisioned by this court's cases. The only thing that Mr. Podlitzka has left to point to in terms of the organized criminal usage is the usage of fences, but this court has twice recognized that there is no other way to dispose of your stolen goods but through fences, and that is not the atypical, unique, rare case that authorizes departure. The only thing that I would say beyond that is that the notion that two other co-defendants can stipulate to something and that binds his co-defendants for purposes of organized crime finds no support in the law. And at the time they made that stipulation, Judge Norgel had long made it clear he was going to impose the enhancement because he said in revoking Mr. Hanhart's bond, the organized crime connections cannot be overlooked in this case. So what Mr. Hanhart did was to enter into a stipulation to spare his family having to sit through a rogues gallery paraded in front of the press. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stays. And Mr. Martin, I believe that you were appointed for Altabello. Well, anyway, thank you to everybody, and the court will be in recess for my 31 days.